thing is I'm going to call up a work session on House Bill 2410. Grant, would you come up and Dr. Higginson, I'm sorry, would you come up and just give us a little rundown on the Dash 6 amendments that I understand are where you want to go?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services. And on Tuesday, we went over the provisions of the bill as described in the Dash 5 amendments. And at that time, there still were a couple of minor concerns expressed by the Hospital Association and by the Oregon Medical Association. And so we have worked with them, and the Dash 6 amendments represent some minor tweaking to the bill. So I don't think we need to go over the all the provisions, but instead just the changes.
Actually, if you would just point out to us where the adjustments have been made, then that would be
great. In Section 4, this is on page 2, lines 12 through 15. There was an issue that in the Dash 5 amendments it referenced an impending public health crisis, and that was not defined. The reason it referenced it is because it's actually in a companion bill, and legislative council is not willing to reference another bill, and so what they have done in this is put in some of the language from that bill so that it would be consistent.
Okay.
And they have said that as the bills move through, this will be corrected. That same language is inserted again on page 3, lines 3 through 6.
Oh, okay.
Right. In Section 4, the issue came up as it says the Department of Human Service may designate health care facilities or other locations as emergency health care centers, and then goes on to say how they will be used. A question was raised, shouldn't it be the other way around, that the emergency happens first and then you designate? And I don't think it really matters, but I did want to go on record as saying that the idea here is that we would designate after an emergency, not designating before.
Okay.
On Section 4, Sub 3, it talks about emergency health care centers and health care facilities needing to have emergency operation plans and credentialing plans. There's been a question of whether or not that means they have to do something new because they have to be comply with rules adopted by the Department of Human Services. And again, I just want to go on record saying that the idea here for health care facilities is that we would be using their existing emergency operation plans and emergency credentialing plans and not asking them to be doing additional work.
Okay.
On page 3, section 5, subsection 2, on we talk here about the health care providers being able to volunteer, and in the previous version on line 14, after section 4, it had subsection 1, and it needed to refer to the entire section, and so that subsection 1 has been deleted. In lines 15 and 16, it says that the services that are being provided by these volunteer workers have to be provided in a manner provided for in Section 6. And then it's in Section 6 that goes in to say that it's the health worker's responsibility to work under the emergency operating plan and credentialing plan as specified by the facility or center, and that it is the facility or center in subsection 2 that really is the one that decides the level of services, the scope of services that individual would be providing. And so with those changes, I believe that all of the key stakeholders are now fine with this version of the bill.
Okay. I understand that. Have you talked with the folks from the, I don't know if it's special districts or pardon?
The fire districts
and the AFSCME folks that might be relative to like local police, local fire, and that sort of thing. Have you visited with them at all?
Mr. Chair, I have not up until this time. Okay. Our task with this was really specifically to work at health care providers rather than other providers. That's what we focused on. That's the advisory group that we pulled together.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just I know that and I'm not going unless I want to come up. But I think that there are a couple of minor issues that they do have, and so what I'm going to ask is that they get with you on the Senate side, so that if there's anything that needs to be done with this bill, and it also may be addressed in 2251, and if that's the case, it may be able to be resolved there, and that's fine. But what I would like to make sure of is that number one, that you don't get blindsided, but number two is that that everybody that's going to be participating, if we run into an emergency type situation, is on board with what we're doing here.
Right. And Mr. Chair, I would be happy to talk with them. Again, our focus was on healthcare workers, and my one concern is if we are going to expand that substantially. I mean, one of the issues that we spent a lot of time with was the risk management side of things, and is the state willing to accept that risk? I'm not sure we'll be able to do the amount of work that might be required to get this fixed in time to get it through this session, but I will be more than happy to speak with them.
Great. Thank you. Representative Kitch.
Mr. Chair, I would move the -6 amendments into House Bill 2410.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kitts moves the -6 amendments into House Bill 2410. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I would move House Bill 2410 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves moves House Bill 2410 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Gina, call the roll, please. Excused.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Hampton.
Excused.
Representative
Dinofsky. Aye.
Excused. Aye. House Bill 2410, as amended, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed to the floor. Who would like to carry that? Is there anybody here that would like to carry that? Do you want to carry it, Representative Przanski, or I can if you...
Whatever the chair would like, I'd be more than glad to do it if you like.
I'll go ahead, and that would be fine if you'd like to carry it. Representative Przanski will be the carrier. I close a work session on House Bill 2410. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3609. And I'm going to ask Representatives Gallegos and Farr if they would come forward, please. As I have, just so that people that you know, as I have members that walk into the room, I'm going to try to get to their bills as quickly as I can. And then we'll move on. So, whenever you're ready, Representatives, just go right ahead. And whoever wants to start, just start.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have very few words to say, so I'll begin, if I may. Mr. Chair, I'm speaking for the 33,831 veterans in Lane County and for the more than 367,000 veterans living in Oregon. House Bill 3609 provides for pilot programs in Lane, Clackamas, and Washington counties to provide an outreach to our veterans to help them in accessing, to assist them in accessing services and programs that they've earned and that they deserve. What's happening now is that many veterans don't know about programs that are in place that have been designed to provide medical services and other services to them. The outreach will help screen them for eligibility and help them and give them the needed help in submitting applications. This sounds like a program that will cost money, but it's been demonstrated that it will save the state, general fund, and Medicaid many times the cost of the program. As is being demonstrated today overseas, our veterans of foreign wars have shown themselves willing to sacrifice everything for our freedom. Let's reward them by helping them access the programs they've earned. Thank you.
Are you going to say anything?
I am.
Mayor, Representative Gallegos, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, colleagues, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Gallegos. I'm a state representative from House District 29, which, of course, Corcoran is, and a good part of Hillsborough. I'm pleased to be able to present to you today House Bill 3609, and it is... I have an offhand. A couple documents that I'd like to share with you. that'll be coming your way. And the Veterans Pilot Project, concentrating on our three counties that have the largest number of veterans in them, this program would provide funding for the veterans service officers, the county veteran service officers, who are accredited and certified with the federal VA programs, to be able to go out and find our veterans who are currently receiving state aid and sign them up for the myriad of federal programs that are available, help them with the bureaucratic paperwork that's there, and get them on those programs that provide better benefit than what we as a state are able to save. But it also allows them to get off of our state programs. A couple of folks who have sent us some testimony, they apologize for not being able to be here. One is Tim Jetterberg. Tim Jetterberg is the County Veterans Service Officer and Vice President of Oregon County Veterans Service Officers Association. He's located in La Grande, Oregon. And his testimony is, I enthusiastically support House Bill 3609. And this bill has the potential of building a foundation of support for veteran services in the state of Oregon that will result in our veterans receiving a much higher percentage of their benefits. In addition, this bill will provide a vehicle by which veterans who are dependent upon Medicaid can replace a high percentage of that dependence with federal VA dollars. This could and will result in savings to the taxpayers of Oregon who currently are veterans in Oregon. It is essential that the funds provided by this bill go to the county veteran service officers, as they are the only people who have acquired the expertise to adequately provide for the needs of our veterans. There is currently no other organization or state agency, with the exception of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, who only have offices in Salem and Portland, who can provide a professional level of services to our veterans. And again, the Oregon County Veterans Service Officer from Washington County, Jeff Hill, is not able to be here this morning. And his testimony in support of this bill outlines, they've been doing this pilot project. It, in the 0103 legislature, was put as a budget note. And unfortunately, during clearly our budget crisis this last year, that funding was cut. But we fortunately have some data that the county continued to track that savings that they were able to receive as they were implementing this project. And that spreadsheet is there on the, at the very back page, as Washington County has indicated the monthly savings that they were able to receive by having a county veteran service officer go out and assist the veterans in our community get signed up to the various programs that are available through the federal VA. I also would point out to you this Veterans Pilot Project report, which was compiled by Mary Lou Ritter and Mary Shortall. Mary Lou Ritter is the director of Washington County Department of Aging and Veterans Services, which, if you turn to page 5, I think that's the most important piece of information, that by mid-Q2, they had broken even on what it was costing them or costing the state to fund the county veteran service officers. In fact, they had a net savings of $88,000. And by Q4, they had clearly outstripped that, and they were at a, about $205,000 that they were receiving in savings as being able to help our veterans get a higher percentage of benefits, helps taxpayers get some off of many of the state programs, and clearly it's a better level of services that are available and benefits to veterans from the federal VA.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kitts?
Patrick, I'm looking at the summary sheet here. Is there been a fiscal on this issue yet?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, I spoke with Monica Brown of the Legislative Fiscal Office this morning, and she was still in process of developing a fiscal impact for the measure.
Was there any anticipation that it may be over $50,000?
In my discussions with her, she indicated that that they typically can't take into account cost savings of the type that are being considered here, and that the pilot programs themselves would probably cost over $50,000 the cost of pilot programs would be over $50,000, and that the savings weren't going to be part of the calculation of the fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, are you planning on moving this to Ways and Means in light of that information?
Actually, I would like to let Representative Gallegos continue to talk about the cost savings and that sort of thing, because it actually may have a different effect as far as the fiscal is concerned than what Legislative Fiscal Office is asserting.
I'm sorry, I thought you were done talking, so I did not mean to interrupt your testimony. And when you said the good part of Hillsborough, what exactly did you mean by
the better
that?
Part of
that's fine. Representative Gallegos, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We do want to put in one amendment in this bill. Clearly, we know we're all out of time. We want to work that on the Senate side. And that is to clearly articulate that would like to have DHS contract with the existing county veteran service officers who are already trained, they are already certified and accredited to deliver these services with the VA. They're already there in the field, already working, and we believe that that would substantially reduce the costs associated, because we're talking about three county veteran service officers, I believe. There might be more than one in Multnomah County. That would significantly reduce it by having DHS contract with those existing ones instead of the overburdened, perhaps, figures that sometimes get passed through to an agency when they do burden costs. And Jacqueline Zimmer is here and will be speaking shortly and can give a little bit more insight into what those costs are specifically. But we do believe that that does significantly lower the cost by contracting directly with those people who are already there doing that.
Okay. So what I'm seeing here on page 5, that's directly from the with regards to cost versus savings. That's specific to Washington County, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So while it had a cost of $75,000, there was a net savings of $205,000, is that?
By the fourth quarter, yes.
By the fourth quarter. Right.
A good important piece of information, Mr. Chair, is Tim Jetterberg, who is the veteran service officer out in LeGrand.
Right.
During the set of cuts that clearly took place over the last year, the funding for that veteran service officer went down to 25% of what it had been previously, which cut significantly into his ability. I mean, he's not part of this pilot project, but had been doing it out there, cut significantly into their ability to deliver, because it's a costly as well as time-consuming process to work through the bureaucracy on behalf of the veterans with the federal VA.
Okay.
And they still were realizing savings, even at 25%, but clearly much less. It was very reactive to many of the issues that veterans were dealing with, as opposed to proactively going out seeking them, as they were able to do before. But this pilot project would realize significant savings beyond what we're seeing in the fourth quartile, had they been able to continue, which, if you notice on the chart that was provided by Jeff Hill, Washington County has continued to track what those savings are and have been with the reduced funding of the veteran service officers.
Okay.
To date, and the second page of that chart shows the totals, being the net savings to date through last year were, looking at the bottom, were $362,000 in Washington County.
Okay, and those are direct savings to the county provided or state provided Medicaid dollars. Is that correct?
Well, that's as a result of individuals receiving their services through the federal VA as opposed to the state. That savings was realized. Where those savings have ended up, they might have been absorbed back into a DHS budget somewhere.
Right.
I don't believe that they were kept there in the county.
Right.
It was a savings to taxpayers.
Okay. Okay. Representative Nelson, do you have a question?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Gallegos and Representative Farr, thank you for being here, and thank you for supporting our veterans. I just want to tell you that my concern in this plan is the discrimination, and that comes from selecting three counties, and that I find very offensive. And I don't know if you're willing to amend your bill, but if you will amend your bill to be all inclusive of our veterans who have received so little for doing so much, I would support it wholeheartedly. Otherwise, I will find it very, very offensive.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I understand the concern there. Certainly isn't our intent to be offensive because of the fiscal impact. The largest savings were able to be realized, or are able to be realized, in the three counties with the largest number of veterans. I would, you know, if there were no issue with the fiscal issue, I would be more than happy to include it everywhere. But if we do that, every county, 36 counties, there aren't veteran services officers in every county. There are veteran service officers who serve multiple counties. So I think we could amend it. I'd be happy to do that. I have no qualms about a county-by-county or veteran service office agency, because in the example of maybe Yamhill, you might not have a veteran service officer. I don't know. Or he may serve multiple counties. And you might know that, and we could certainly be happy to work on an amendment.
Thank you very much. That makes me feel very, very, very...
And I want you to feel good.
Let me ask you this, Representative Gallegos. Is there anything in state law that would prevent, for example, Yamhill County, you know, because Union County has a service officer. Is there anything in state law that would prohibit or keep Yamhill County from going ahead and contracting with a certified service officer and providing these services to the veterans in Yamhill County?
Mr. Chair, I don't know what would prevent. I mean, I'm not knowledgeable in that area.
Okay, so it might not be something that necessarily is funded through the state, but the state actually could realize benefits and savings and that sort of thing if Yamhill County said, you know, we're going to go ahead and do this and we want to have a service officer. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I believe that is correct. The one concern that I had is that there is a cost initially to the program, and by doing it in three counties, we would more or less eliminate the shock of the overall cost of the program initially, and demonstrate that we can save potentially millions of dollars for the Department of Human Services, and get more people enthusiastic about spreading the program throughout the state.
Okay,
Mr. Chair, just a brief comment.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Representative Farr. You know, I think it'd be very hard to distinguish which veterans deserve, you know, this service. And, you know, one having fought more or less or done more or less. So we do have a most outstanding woman in our Yamhill County handling this type program. She also assists various other counties, you know, who need the help. So I once again would... ask you to make it all inclusive, and I'd be grateful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I agree with you. No one deserves it any more than another. Every single one does deserve the assistance.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we'd be more than happy to work on something as it moves to the Senate side, given the timeline, and something that would make you happy.
Right. Given the time frame that we have, we do need to move this along. Representative Mabry?
I'll be very brief. I'll certainly support the pilot program. I think it's great. I think Representative Nelson is correct. We have veteran service officers all over the state that do outstanding job with limited resources. I know in Wasco County we share a veteran service officer with Hood River County and supplement that budget. And she on her own is traveling out to Gillum County and Sherman County and Wheeler County trying to help those folks. folks because they don't have a service officer out there. Any of these savings that could in somehow be brought back in to enhance those programs would probably for another session, but a goal that I think we should look forward to.
Thank you. I have a little bit of personal knowledge of these service officers and the work that they do. My mother is a veteran and has we have been able to avail her to some of the services of the service officers up in Yakima, Washington, and she's now in a nursing home over in Vancouver. But with their help, we were able to obtain some veterans benefits for my mother. That part of the savings, then there ended up being about almost $3,000 in savings that went back to the Washington State Department of DHS, and because of the Medicaid federal statutes, it did create a there is a mechanism in place for those dollars to go back, and so it saved the state of Washington some dollars as well as being able to avail a veteran of some benefits that quite frankly we didn't realize were available. So it was kind of a pleasant surprise. Representative Brzezinski.
Yeah, if I can just get one clarification. The veteran service officers, they are employed by who?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, it's a different mechanism in each county. In Washington County, it's through the Washington County Department of Aging and Veteran Services.
County employee.
Typically through the county, but it's, you know, each county is organized differently.
Okay.
And as Representative Mabry mentioned, there's one county service or one veteran service officer from multiple counties that they share that officer.
And I would assume what I'm hearing is possibly some of the other counties contract with the, let's say, call the host county to do that. If I could ask.
Sure. Go ahead.
Representative Barr, knowing that we have the VA office in Eugene, is it contemplated that we would have someone that's at Lane County? I guess it would be someone separate from the VA office who is the VA service officer working with those individuals to try to do this interfacing that we've heard about?
Probably that would be the case. It would be an additional level of service that we're providing inside of the county, and I would guess there's going to be a coordination between the two entities.
Does Lane County actually have a veteran service officer?
Yes, I believe. Trying to think of the name, but I can get back to you on that, Representative Brzezinski. Get you the name on that.
I assume that's through the health department. I'm just curious because I thought everything had been handled at the local federal VA. But it sounds like we actually have someone that's in the county government that is also facilitating.
Let me get you a definitive answer on that, Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you.
If I could comment.
Go ahead, Representative Gallegos.
Chair Crummell and Representative Brzezinski. The Federal Veterans Service Office in Eugene does on a statewide basis for a large region. They don't have someone who actually goes out into the field as would the county veteran service officer who actually goes out, finds these folks, and actually does more hands-on locating them, finding out what their circumstances are, and helping them facilitate through that process, which actually he would go work, as would many county veteran service officers, with that particular entity in Eugene or Salem, wherever they're at. That county veteran service office works with to facilitate speeding up the process, working through the bureaucracy. Okay. And I don't think that it is replicated at all to have that office in Eugene and a service officer in the field there. Mm-hmm. It's based on the volume of veterans in those counties.
Great. Thanks for the clarification.
Okay. Are there any other questions or comments? Okay. Great. Thank you both, representatives. I appreciate it. I'm going
to... I apologize for leaving the meeting. We're working the tourism tax That's
quite all right. Thank you, Representative. I appreciate your being here. I'm going to temporarily recess the work session on 3609 because I have Representative Close has come in, and we have one of her bills on the agenda, so I want to go ahead and go to that so that she can testify. And so I'd like to recess the work session on 3609. We will come back to that, however. So don't send that back with your staff yet. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3114. And Representative Close, would you go ahead and come on up and bring your guests with you too, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for allowing us to be before you today on House Bill 3114. And I have with me this morning one of the people that would be affected by this bill. And it's my pleasure to introduce to you Chris Nagabani, and he is from Corvallis. He goes to Franklin School there, and he has some testimony for you this morning.
Mr. Chair, I'm Chris Nagabani of Boy Scout Troop 170. I'm from Corvallis, Oregon. I just wanted to thank you, take the opportunity to thank you for allowing me to come in and speak on my troop's behalf. Like I said, I'm a Star Scout in Troop 170. I'm a patrol leader and a den chief. Recruiting in schools is one of the main sources of recruiting new Boy Scouts for our patrol. And 3 years ago, I received a Boy Scout recruiting flyer from school, and that's what brings me here today. Banning these recruitment sheets in the schools is an injustice to the boys who will miss out on the opportunities to know what scouting is about. In scouting, I've learned many skills, including camping, canoeing, fishing, aviation, archery, and many more. Scouting has and continues to teach me the importance of teamwork, setting and accomplishing my goals, citizenship, and how to become a better citizen in my community. Scouting has opened many doors of opportunity for me and many other scouts. And I believe that no boy should miss out on the opportunities that scouting provides, which includes helping boys become honorable, respectable, and productive citizens. Being a scout has given me the courage, strength, and skills to come here today and speak to you about this important topic. And it's now I ask for your support on Bill 3114. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for either Chris or Representative Close? Representative Kuzanski?
Thank you. Representative Close, just looking at the dash threes, which I guess we got this morning, that makes reference on line 4 and 5, youth group means any youth group listed in Title 36 of the U.S. Code as a patriotic organization. Do you have any information as to what that list includes or doesn't include?
Representative Przanski, I just happen to have
excellent
a
day
copy for you, and I apologize, I have not gotten it up there yet.
And if I could ask one other question.
Go ahead, Representative Przanski.
The current limitations that maybe some of the school districts may have, Representative, is my understanding is during the hours of school when classes are actually taking place. My understanding, I thought that most school districts have, I want to call it an open door policy for organizations to meet either before or after. Is the intent of 3114 with the dash threes have adopted is to open the time that is usually reserved for instructions, classroom, et cetera, to these various groups and organizations?
Chair Crummel, Representative Przanski, in the prelude to the bill, it says allow all youth groups access to schools under the same terms and conditions. So my understanding is that it still leaves it up to the school district, the terms and conditions, which would be whether what the time would be, what the building would be, even if there would be a fee. It just assures that all would be charged the same fee and be given the same type of access. On the list, I'll just tell the committee, we have two options here. On the list, you're including a lot of adults here, and you're taking out the reference to youth, which wasn't my intent. I wanted the youth portion left in the bill and then tying it to the national organization list. And legislative council has taken out the youth definition. So the dash threes aren't exactly what we had intended.
Oh.
So it's been suggested to me that maybe we should go with the original bill and try to make another amendment on the Senate side. It would be the committee's pleasure.
Okay. Okay. So,
in other words, Mr. Chair, you're allowing adult access too with this list.
Right.
And that wasn't our intent.
That's not the intent.
We don't have any objection to these groups, but it's much broader access.
It's much broader than what you were anticipating.
Right.
So, Representative, with the list that's from the U.S. code,
mm-hmm.
This is both a youth list as well as a adult list. Is that
correct
in that?
And then legislative council has taken out line.
And by taking out youth
16
group?
16 and 17, they've taken it out, and that's the definition of youth groups.
Okay.
And
so
they haven't restored the reference to youth, I don't believe, unless I'm maybe Representative Krasanski can help us with that, being an attorney. I believe they've taken out the reference to youth group. Is that correct?
For students. But it talks about students in what would be the sub three there, on beginning on line 8. It says each public education provider shall allow reasonable opportunities for students to receive written and oral information from youth groups during school hours when a school is normally in operation. Would that retain the intent of what you're talking about there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that would.
And I don't know if you're reading that the same way, Representative Brzezinski.
If I understand, if we stay with the original bill with no amendments to it, looking at lines 16 and 17, when it defines youth group as it does, it's basically saying any group that's intended to serve persons that are under 21 of age. That's pretty, I mean, it's really broad. And I guess my concern, knowing what has happened in our community, we've actually had distribution or attempt to distribute for what I would consider hate groups, of organizing and trying to get individuals to join those groups. And I'm really, I understand what we're trying to, or what Representative Close wants to be able to do. And I'm really concerned as to, one, do we want those type of groups to have access to our kids? And two, if you take the dash three, I mean, just at a glance looking at the groups, can we actually limit to what has been defined as a patriotic organization as compared to others? I'm just wondering the constitutionality, which seems like it would be questionable. If you open it up to one, I thought there was something, and I'm not as familiar as I wish I was, Leave No Child Behind legislation, but I think there's some other maybe concerns as to if you open up for one, you have to have open for all, and you can't limit it to a specific group. I don't know if Representative Close has had any opportunity to review that to make certain wouldn't be putting something up that's unconstitutional or maybe unintentionally allowing groups that we would not want our children to be exposed to.
Okay.
Chair Cromwell, we do have a call in to Cindy Hunt to discuss that issue. She was not in her office this
she's
morning.
She's here.
Right. And she is walking up right behind you as you speak, Representative.
Thank you.
You have such power. Such
extreme
power.
Cindy, would you help us out with a couple of the questions that are
going to
come up, please?
Certainly.
Cindy Hunt, Legislative Council's office. Could you repeat the specific questions that you had? Because in transit, I think I may have missed some of them.
There was one of the questions that that I think Representative Close was, and I was trying to be helpful. I'm not sure I was, but trying to be helpful on, and that is in the Dash 3 amendments. She was concerned, Representative Close was concerned about removing the definition of youth groups in line 16 and 17 of the original printed bill. And I had suggested that in lines 8 through 10 of the amendments of the Dash 3 amendments, that that was because it was talking about reasonable opportunities for students to receive both written and oral information from youth groups during school hours when a school is normally in operation. And then I just noticed that in on lines 4, youth group, and then it says means any youth group listed in Title 36 of the United States Code as a patriotic organization. So is that so there was that issue, and then Representative Przanski was raising an issue of constitutionality, and I believe, Representative, correct me if I'm wrong, please, that you're probably relating to the Oregon Constitution, or are you referring to the U.S. Constitution?
I think it could be both. I mean, both? Definitely Oregon seems to give more, let's say, safeguards to citizens than you know, the threshold that we find in the U.S. Constitution. But I think looking at the Dash 3s, and I know that we're kind of going back and forth whether the Dash 3s are going to go forward, but it appears to me that lines 8 through 10 may have a constitutional problem. And then the question about 4 and 5 on Dash 3s, when you limit it to a specific defined group, are we somehow running amok as to allowing for some but not all to have that access?
Wow, lots of questions.
Yeah. Sorry you came down so quick.
Okay. Chair Crummell, Representative Przanski, other committee members. Originally what this bill is based on is federal law. And so let me start there. So there's two federal laws right now that exist. One's been around since 1986, and it basically says to the school districts, if you have a public high school that receives public federal funds, if you open your doors to one group, you need to open them to all groups. And you need to do that equally. So if you charge a fee, for example, to one group, you need to charge the same fee to the other group. If you set specific hours, for example, I think Portland Public Schools says the groups can come in between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m. and use the facilities for free. Those hours have to apply to all groups. Then back, I think it was last year, No Child Left Behind Act was passed, and it also has a provision on this issue in it. And what it says, and it's a little less clear, to be frank. So what it says is that if you have an open forum, and it doesn't define what that is, but I'm assuming it goes back to the other act, and you let in youth groups, you have to very specifically, if you have a kindergarten through grade 12 school receiving federal funds, you have to very specifically let in the Boy Scouts and any youth group that's a patriotic organization listed in Title 36, is what it specifically says. And so basically, if a school district violates either of those, they run the risk of losing federal funds currently. Okay, so now enter our new state bill here and how that would affect everything. So in the original bill sort of followed the original federal law in that it said if you open up your doors to any youth group or community group, you need to open them up equally to all other youth groups. And if you don't do that, then you run the risk of losing state dollars. Okay. So I don't necessarily see a constitutional issue with the original bill because you're treating all groups the same. And regardless of the speech of the group or, I don't know, any other factors in the group. And that kind of follows with constitutional law in this area as well. Okay, so now the Dash 3 amendments. And what they do is they say, okay, so we've replaced the definition of youth group in the bill with the definition from basically the No Child Left Behind Act, which says for the entire bill, and that's on lines 4 and 5 of the Dash 3 amendments. Youth group means any youth group listed in Title 36 of the United States Code as a patriotic organization. And like I said, that's right out of No Child Left Behind. Now, I do think this does raise some constitutional concerns for the Oregon Constitution, and that you are treating youth groups that are patriotic organizations somewhat differently, or giving them a special status as opposed to other youth groups. And when I've looked at Title 36, I know it does not include all youth groups that currently do have access to Oregon schools. I don't know, like 4-H clubs, different choir groups, there's others. Anyway, so I do have some concerns around that. But I wanted to emphasize that the original bill we don't necessarily have concerns over.
Okay.
So.
Mr. Chair, I had one question of Cindy. And that was, groups like 4-H that are state-funded groups anyway, they are essentially a government youth group. Doesn't this just apply to private youth groups?
Chair Crummell, Representative Close, the original federal law applied to non-curriculum related youth groups. And so I think 4-H is non-curriculum related. And, you know, and it, I think the youth group would vary from school to school as far as, you know, there's some that are very specific for the school. The list in Title 36, I know that includes groups like the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, FFA. There are some others on there that I'm not sure if they have youth groups or not. But the original federal law applies to any youth group regardless of where they get their funding from. I mean, so it would apply to 4-H, for example, as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, it appears to me that the original bill is probably the one that would avoid constitutional problems.
And get to the goal that you're trying to get to?
That is correct, but as Representative Przanski says, when you allow all access, and this is what free speech does, is you allow all access.
And Chair Crow, I want to emphasize that in the original bill, it would cover the Boy Scouts. So if a school district allows any non-curriculum group in, they allow the Boy Scouts in equally.
Mm-hmm.
But then the school district could choose to not allow any in, but they have to do it equally. I mean.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Krasinski.
Cindy, if we can just follow up on that. It appears to me that then the school district would also have the option of limiting the time, space, or the time during the day that any of these groups would be able to participate. In other words, morning, academic, post-academic, or during the academic hours. Is that correct?
Representative Przanski, that's correct. So I think most school districts, what they do is they limit the time to, like, after-school hours. And so as long as they do it equally,
yeah.
You know, and
equal
same
access.
With the fees and the utility mm-hmm. fees, and it has to be equal.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Representative Close, and I sure am proud of the scout here who had the courage to come today. My question, I guess, is for both Representative Close and Cindy Hunt. I'm curious on the amendment that all of a sudden, now having been a sponsor of, I don't know, probably 10 or 12 of these groups in my lifetime with all my kids, we were never allowed to use school during school hours. So in the amendment, the lines 8 through 10, I'm surprised about. In the original bill, this is before and after hours, as in line 7 under section 1. And now in the amendment, we're allowing this to occur during school hours, which is pretty offensive in that the taxpayers feel they're paying for public education at the time. So I'm curious of how that got in there.
Representative Nelson, Chair Crummell, what you're referring to in lines 8 to 10 of the amendment is, I think, a somewhat different issue, which is the original bill dealt with the issue of youth groups meeting in the school, whereas lines 8 to 10 deal with the kinds of information or the access the youth groups have to the students of the school. So it's a slightly different issue. And so in lines 8 to 10, that's something that's not necessarily covered by federal law currently. I think different school districts have different policies around that. I know that some of them, the way they deal with this currently is that, for example, they'll say to the youth groups, give us a sheet of paper that we'll staple to our newsletter and send home with the children. Or they allow posting on bulletin boards of information, that kind of thing. And so it'll vary from school district to school district. And so what this portion of the amendment would do is direct these school districts that they have to allow opportunities for written and oral during the school hours. So that is that is different than a lot of the school policies currently.
Yes, a follow-up, please.
Follow-up, Representative Nelson.
I would recommend, if we are going to amendment that this bill, that be stricken, because, you know, right now where we're already cutting days of school because of funding, and then all of a sudden we find ourselves allowing, you know, the school period to be used, actual school instruction time, when we want, you know, at least 80% of the time money spent in actual classes. I think that should be stricken and not be allowed.
Representative Nelson, Chair Crumble, this provision is not in the introduced bill either. So if these amendments are not adopted, this provision is not in the bill.
And, Mr. Chair, it was not our intent to do it during school hours. We were looking for equal access.
Before school, after school, lunch hour, which actually they don't have lunch hours, but lunchtime.
Half hours.
Lunch half hours, lunch 20 minutes.
And then one quick follow-up.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
In our last session, we passed the anti-bully bill. And in relationship to a question that came from Representative Brzezinski about, you know, allowing groups that may be, use hate to perpetuate hate programs or crimes or campaigns. I'm just wondering if that anti-bully law would not take care of that, of those type of groups.
Chair Crumble, Representative Nelson, you raise an interesting question, because the federal law currently does not distinguish between groups who may have messages that could be seen as hate and other groups would be anti-hate or that kind of thing. And it's not something that's necessarily addressed in the federal law. So the school districts presently have an interesting dilemma in front of them, in that if they are approached by one of these groups that has a hate message, they sort of have this choice of allowing them to use the facilities and not violating federal law, but doing something that their community probably is not in favor of. And so that's an issue currently under the federal law, and it would remain under this. The way I recall the harassment and bullying law from last session, though, it dealt with, I think, between school hours. And these groups are meeting after school hours.
And I believe, if I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I believe we also required every school district, and I've not seen those yet, to write and adapt and adopt a program that would be restricted. Maybe we ought to look at those.
Chair Crumble, could I comment? Any group that breaks the law, the schools could automatically exclude. And any criminal behavior, harassment, threats, assault. So those are prohibited already in law, and so you would not have a group coming in being allowed to do that, because those are illegal activities.
Sorry, I should have specified that. Yeah, certainly if you have a group that's breaking the law, yeah. I mean, that's a different
school
issue.
Law, right. Being state law, I don't know.
Well, they can't break the criminal code, is what I'm saying, Representative Nelson.
I was as relating to the anti-bully policy and harassment.
Okay. Representative Mabry.
Am I understanding this, Representative Close, am I understanding this bill correctly, that this requires the schools to let every organization in, and therefore takes away the option of the school saying nobody comes or everybody comes. Is that not correct? My concern here is I'm assuming that we've got a Boy Scout here. The concern is somebody's going to exclude Boy Scouts from having access to the school. And I would certainly be opposed to that. But I also would not like to lock myself into a position that I have to open up my school to the youth for Nazi party or some such thing. I'd like to have some local control on being able to do that without discriminating in any way. But if there's something that's going to require schools to do this, then how do we get beyond that is what I'm getting at.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Mabry, you already have in federal law, as Cindy was saying, laws that say that you have to treat groups equally as long as they're lawful. They're within the law. And so what this says is that they do have the choice to deny access, but they have to do that equally to all groups that are law-abiding. And so they still have the option, but and I would just say again, this, when you have, in our U.S. Constitution, the right to free speech, you also allow speech that is objective, that you don't agree with. And that's the kind of country that we live in. And we allow that freedom because we believe it's important, but you also have speech that people object to when you allow that.
Okay. Are there any, Representative Brzezinski?
Yeah. The 1986 law, if I understood, Cindy, it was limited to high schools.
Correct. Representative, you're correct, although No Child Left Behind curiously says kindergarten through grade 12.
But it also has a different approach because of the limits of of the groups on that Title 36.
Yes, Representative Perkinsansky, and I'm pulling out the exact language here. Here we go. Representative Przanski, what it says is that, essentially, if you have an open forum or a limited public forum, which means, and I'm reading that in conjunction with the other law since there's not a definition here, which means that if you've let in other groups, then you must let in the youth groups that are listed in that Title 36. So that is slightly different.
Okay. Mm-hmm. One other clarification.
Clarification, sure.
On the 86, as we pretty well documented, it's for high schools. Also limited as to groups that are led by students as compared to, quote, unquote, outside groups?
I think that's correct. It's led by students. Although I think the open forum definition applies not just to the youth groups led by students, it's also if you've let in local community groups, then you have to let in the student groups.
Okay, thank you.
One last.
Representative Nelson and then Representative Worth.
Thank you. Want to be sure. Is there a way in which organizations that are not listed here can become a part of it? I'll give you an example. For example, in one of our now middle schools, we organized a group called the Carousel Kids. And these were kids who went to the happened to be Carousel Retirement Homes and, after school and put programs together. So we recruited and trained, and they have all sorts of babysitting clinics and senior babysitting clinics and, promoted volunteer projects and clubs. Are we included, I hope?
Representative Nelson, in the original bill, I'm assuming what you're talking about is a youth group, basically, and it fits the definition. So, yes, you are.
Of any.
Right. But if you're asking, are you included in Title 36, I'm guessing you're not, and that's an issue with the federal government, because they're the ones that created that list.
And again, Chair Cromwell, Representative Nelson, we feel that the dash threes are not the amendment that we want put forward. So though the list is here, there's constitutional problems that Cindy has.
So you're thinking stay with the original bill?
That would be my choice.
All right. Representative Worth.
So can you, I'm sure you're familiar with the
Corral School District non-discrimination policy. Can you tell me how your bill would change that?
Representative Wirth, Chair Crummell, the way I understand the Corvallis policy to be is I think they're still letting in, I mean, there was a big discussion for many months down there, and I know they did discuss excluding the Boy Scouts and some other groups. What I believe their current policy, though, to be is that they let in all groups. And I think they're charging everyone a utility fee, if I'm not mistaken, but I think they're doing that across the board. So, and the other thing that the Corvallis School District does is that they allow groups to have like a piece of paper that's attached to like a newsletter sent home with the parents or the kids or whatever. And so everything that I've seen about the Corvallis School District's current policy, I think they are meeting federal law at this point. And I think that they would also be in compliance with the introduced bill.
So, can I follow up?
So I've spent too much time on the amendment and trying to figure out what the amendment. So about the amendment, give me a quick synopsis of what you're saying this is okay. doing. That
we're without not the amendment. Without the amendment, I don't think that the Corvallis School District's policy would necessarily change because I think they're allowing, right now, they're allowing equal access to all youth groups and they're treating them the same.
Okay.
I think, if my assumption is correct.
So, so what school districts will have to change based upon the implementation of this bill in Oregon?
Representative Crummell, I think what is up in the air at all this with Corvallis and other schools is that they had an intent to block, and so this bill makes it clear that they cannot do that. That's why this bill is needed. They are charging a fee. It's not clear to me whether they're collecting it right now because they're watching what we're doing here and also the federal level to see if they are in violation. So I understand they're charging the scouts a fee, but they're not collecting it. So I believe we do need to make it clear at this level.
A final follow-up.
Under
your bill, this would then at the state level send out a direct message to school districts that they would then now be prevented access they would not be able to prevent access by white supremacist and anti-Semitic organizations. Is that correct?
Representative Cole, Representative Worth, again, as long as groups are lawful within the law, they are not harassing, they are not intimidating, inciting riots, as long as they're within the law, then yes, you allow access to law-abiding groups. I think the groups that you're talking about would be right on the line of whether they're lawful or not. Right.
Right.
Representative
Kitts. I agree with Representative Close. That is a gray area. While we may disagree philosophically and ideologically, they do have beliefs that probably are not outside of the law. My question is will this bill, I share the same concern that Representative Mabry does about directing local school districts, however there's been precedent set for that in the past. Does this bill exclude anybody from coming into the schools as defined by as long as their youth group? Is that the caveat that I'm making sure that I want to make sure I'm connecting? I don't want to exclude anybody, and I may disagree with them, but I think that even though those that I agree with may come on, I think those that I disagree with have that same right. I'd let them know I disagree with them, but they have the right.
Representative Kitts, it's an all or nothing kind of a thing. So the school district could, make it clear under the introduced bill, they could exclude everyone, all non-curriculum related groups. I don't know of any Oregon school districts that have chosen to do that at the present time. I do know there's some school districts in other states that have chosen to do that under the current federal law.
Mr. Chair,
but they could exclude all or they don't exclude any. It's an all or nothing.
Okay. Follow up, Representative Kitts.
But I understand it. But this one, it says here, directs public education providers to allow all youth access or all youth groups access to schools under the same terms and conditions. So, to be able to exclude all, this would preempt that, would it not? Because it's directing them to allow, not the option to include or exclude.
Down on lines 18 to 20 of the bill, it says, if a public ed provider has established a limited public forum in a school controlled by the provider, then they shall allow the youth groups. And the limited public forum means that they've allowed an opportunity or offered that opportunity to youth groups and community groups to meet in the school. So if they have never, if they've said, no, we're not going to allow these other groups to meet, then they don't have to do the directive of the bill.
Okay. Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm wondering how, I don't expect that we're going to provide any money to school districts to implement this. So how is this going to be policed? And how are we going to expect schools to now make sure that they're complying with this law in the current budget crisis that they are facing?
Representative Worth, Chair Crummell, the way the bill is it's if the superintendent of public instruction finds that they're violating the act, then she has various powers to withhold state monies. And so the way this would work, I mean, presently there's statutes that talk about if a school district violates state law or discriminates and these kinds of things that you can file a complaint with the superintendent of public instruction. And so it would be up to the superintendent to police. So I assume what would happen is that if someone had an issue with their local school district's policy, they would file a complaint with the superintendent. She would conduct an investigation and a hearing. And then if she determines that they are in violation of this, this bill directs her to withhold the state monies due to that, due to the school district, until they are in compliance.
I follow up, Mr. Chair. And assuming she has the money to do this, first of all, but is there anything to prevent, Lon Mabon and the OCA going around and checking on school districts to see if they comply with what he interprets the bill as?
Representative Worth, I don't think there's anything to prevent any citizen or anyone in the state from going around and checking with local school district policy to see if they comply. Lon Mabon or anyone.
But that would be the case anyway,
right.
Irrespective
anyone.
Of whatever policy we
Correct.
Have. Anybody can walk into any
right.
school district in the state
yes.
and say, I want to know if you're complying with XYZ law.
Right. And
well, and, yeah.
Standing?
But my question is how do you then prove you're complying or not complying? I mean, it's...
Yeah. Under current law, if a school district has is considered, if there's been a complaint that they're like a non-standard school or that they're... allowing, for example, religious activity into the school. There's a specific statute about that as well. Like I said, there is a complaint, and the school and the superintendent, they do an investigation and a hearing. And so at that point, the school district presents the cases that I'm aware of. For example, they presented their policies, testimony, et cetera, and, you know, it's a typical hearing. And then the hearings officer makes a determination and a recommendation to the superintendent. I should say most school districts, if they get to that point, I mean, they comply with state law. They don't get to the point that state money is withheld. I only know of one instance where state money was withheld in the last, like, 10 years, and it had to do with school district merger and a school district that did not want to merge, and they held out for a year before they merged and complied with state law.
Okay. Representative Krasinski, you have a question?
Cindy, interesting thing that just came up. Standing, as to who actually would have standing to challenge. Did I hear in the conversation that anyone in the state could go into any school district? Isn't there some nexus that would be required?
Representative Krasinski, I think that was in reference to, of course, currently you could go into your local school board and complain.
Right.
And anyone could go in there. I'm assuming the local school board would give more weight to, you know, one of their own residents. But,
right.
I mean, you could, in theory. And then in regards to the superintendent, the issue is just whether or not the school district's in compliance with state law. I don't know that there's a standing issue there necessarily.
Right.
Okay. Last question.
Thank you.
Because we got to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cindy, didn't I recall, or am I recalling properly, that we voted in last session, and also Representative Close, that all school facilities, public school facilities, are open for all schools now? I recall we voted, which mm-hmm. also included religious schools, private schools, in last session.
Representative Nelson.
To use the facilities.
I don't remember that law at all.
Can we check on it?
Yeah, and I don't. I know that there is currently a law that directs the school boards to manage their facilities, and you know, and manage the hours that they can be used, and that kind of a thing. But I don't know of any that directs them to open up their facilities. I know there's been some discussions about charter schools, for example, using facilities and things like that, but there's not a directive that they do that.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask for clarification?
Clarification,
maybe
Representative
you can
Worth.
Clarify me. Am I understanding that there's no school currently in Oregon in violation of what you're proposing?
Representative Worth, to my knowledge, no, there is not.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative, thank you very much. I have other members that are coming in on other bills, so I'm going to need to recess this work session, and hopefully we will get back to it.
Thank you for all your time, everyone.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate it. I'm going to recess the work session on House Bill 3414. Don't send that one back with your staff yet. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3573. Representative Dingfelder. Did you have a statement you wanted to make since I see you here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, for the record, my name is Jackie Dingfelder. I represent House District 45. I'd like to ask some of the proponents of this bill to come up. I'm actually just going to introduce folks here and see if there's any questions. You should have the Dash 2 amendments in front of you. And I also want to thank the chair and the committee for entertaining a work session on this bill. We've made some changes in the Dash 2 amendments. If you'd like, I can walk through those, or I don't know if Patrick wants to do that. But I also have the experts here in case there are some questions, so I can sneak back to my committee.
Okay. Are there any questions with regards to the Dash 2? Do you want to just tell us what the Dash 2s are going to do real quickly?
Or you I'd be happy to do that if you'd like. Mr. Chair, the Dash 2 amendments hopefully are in front of you. Does everybody have a copy? We increase the number of representatives from the business community from 1 to 2 because we believe they're a vital part of the solution, since we're really looking to promote a public-private partnership in eradicating poverty in the state of Oregon. We also remove the representative from the Oregon Food Bank because that organization's interest is already represented by the individual from the Hunger Relief Task Force. The Oregon Food Bank, just for clarification, serves on the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, which I'm also a member of. We've also changed the education representative from the president of the State Board of Higher Education to the superintendent of public instruction, which is what we originally intended. And, of course, we've checked with the superintendent of public instruction to make sure that's copacetic as well. And we removed the clause that granted the commission subpoena power. We didn't think that was necessary. Not sure how that got in there, but we asked LC to eliminate that. We changed the meeting intervals from at least every month to every 3 months, and then we added a sunset clause ending the commission on December 31st, 2009, which would allow the commission to report to the next 3 legislative assemblies. We've also modified language to address agency concerns regarding potential cost. And I will respectfully request the committee that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means because we are going to be seeking private funding, and we've also talked with the governor's office about this, and they're supportive.
Okay, so my understanding is that even with the Dash 2's legislative fiscal thinks that it still needs to go to Ways and Means?
So that's correct, Mr. Chair. We've been working with them to make sure that we minimize any fiscal impacts, and as of this morning, we are requesting to rescind that because we've been assured that there will be very minimal impacts, partially because we'll be seeking private funding for this commission.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody here wants, for the record, and want to address that as well.
My name is Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rocky Johnson. I'm the legislative chair for the Community Action Directors of Oregon. We have, as we mentioned before, set up a 501c3 corporation specifically designed to raise funding for the commission. It already has raised some funds, and as this bill gets through the process, we will have much more success in terms of raising the additional funds needed. So we are convinced wholeheartedly that we can raise enough funds to pay for the commission without having any cost come to the state government.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Prusinski.
So the last statement, not needing state funding at all?
Correct.
So is there any startup? I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, for the record, is there anything that we need to be concerned with as to why it should continue to go to Ways and Means? It sounds to me that based on the dash twos and the intent of the proponents, we're looking at taking away any financial obligations from the state.
That's correct.
That's correct. And there's supposed to be something from the governor's office.
Sure. Representative Kitts?
Yeah, if what you're saying is accurate, would it be appropriate to bring this back when you've actually raised the money? Are we putting the cart before the horse in this situation is my only concern.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kitts, the concern is that without having this in place, it's very difficult to go out and raise money. I mean, it's sort of like saying we're going to start this, so the fact is that part of the intent of this is, and let me just step back a little bit, just a reminder, the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, which already is operating, part of it is that we don't have all the agencies and all the folks that are really concerned about the root causes of hunger, and that's one of the reasons that we wanted to create this. And partially, right now, there are no private representatives on that group. I mean, we're really trying to make this a public-private partnership, and by expanding the membership, that will also help bring in the business community, which can help us raise the money for this. So I do believe that this is necessary for us to be effective in our fundraising, and also this will expand the purview of the agencies who participate in this as well.
Follow up, Representative Gibbs.
Briefly, I would respectfully just disagree with that notion with this regard, is that it would appear that if you're trying to raise money to achieve a goal, i.e., if we raise X amount of money, then we can go to the legislature as a viable entity, as opposed to give us the entity and then we'll raise the money. I support your concept, and I've told the folks that have been in my office about it. I support the concept. I think it's a good idea. But I'm just a little leery of just simply starting something and then saying, okay, we'll go get the money, as opposed to saying, okay, we've got the money, now we need you to start it, and it's in place. So those are my concerns.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Members of the committee, we are a statewide network, and we have programs that serve counties throughout the state. So we have a lot of members, we have a lot of potential to raise dollars, and I have absolutely no doubt that we can raise whatever is required to conduct the business of this commission.
Who said Mr. Chair? Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you. Having, you know, been greatly concerned about hunger since way back before I even came here, and having worked on this program, and knowing that hunger undermines everything we do, you know, we ask for it to be a top priority. Last session and this session. What we find is we already have funds available, you know, for this type of program. I mean, as in millions and millions. It's my understanding that in one PUC account, just in the $3 charge just for PGE, we already have $80 million sitting there doing nothing, when we could feed the state in a heartbeat. And I find this very offensive and wrong, and I think we need to go after it back. My concern is, I think it's excellent that we're not asking for dollars However, since they've already established, amazingly to me, PUC's already established a 501(c) organization with a director, can we just apply for those funds? And we don't even have to go through state government to apply for those funds since they're charitable already? And get on with it and get this done?
I can address this. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm somewhat familiar with the public purposes charge, and you know, with your last session when we passed SB, I think it was 1149. And my understanding is that those monies have to go directly to energy conservation. I'd certainly be more than happy to look into it. And if we are eligible, I think we would certainly apply, and we will look into that. But that's my understanding. I haven't looked specifically at the application, but we'll certainly take a look. I think it is available for low-income energy assistance, is my understanding.
Just the last remark. It seems to me that, once again, we are having to do something that we shouldn't be having to do. That these agencies that are already in place, I mean, should have taken care of it. So I have concern of which should be replaced, you know, the agency with this task force and no charge, because you're going to make something happen and the agencies didn't.
Okay. Are there any other questions or comments for this? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Adrian, do you want to go ahead and come on up, please? I just want to get something on the record. Good morning.
Good morning.
You want to tell us your name for the
sure.
record?
We, for the record.
We know who you are. But
Adrian Sexton, Legislative Fiscal Office.
Thank you. With regards to House Bill 3573, there's an assertion by the proponents that with the dash two amendments that the bill actually would not need to go to Ways and Means, and they would like for us to rescind subsequent referral to Ways and Means and send it directly to the floor. Can you give us some input on that, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The Dash 2 amendments, and I'm afraid I haven't had an opportunity to actually hand engross them so that I know precisely line by line what they do, but I have compared it in terms of the original bill and the areas of the measure that, from the legislative fiscal office's perspective, still carry a fiscal effect. While the bill does not appropriate money, nor does it create an expenditure limitation, it creates an implication that one will occur. Fiscal impact and the function of the Ways and Means Committee in budgeting is not necessarily simply saying that general fund will go to an agency or that's provided expenditure limitation, but in this case, Section 5 of the measure, even as the Dash 2 amendments would be applied, don't affect Section 5, where it indicates that members of the committee are, of these advisory and technical committees are not entitled to compensation but may, at the discretion of the governor, receive reimbursement for travel and other expenses for their functioning as members of the committees. And it's the specific line 38 says that it may be reimbursed from funds available to the governor. The governor has a budget, and it would, in our read, mean that if somebody wanted to place a claim for reimbursement of expenses, the governor would have to draw from funds available to the governor.
Okay. Sure. Representative Brzezinski.
But in your reading of that, I thought it said that it was discretionary on the part of the governor. If the governor, he or she, would have the opportunity to say, we will or we won't be reimbursing for these expenses, so someone's not going to be able to place a claim unless there's actually the authority from the governor?
Mr. Chair and Representative Prozanski, that's true. And I certainly don't want to try to read what the governor's response to that might be. We would say that because this is permissive, even though it's subject to the governor's discretion, the governor may believe that in order, in this case, to engage the membership to make sure that in this era of seeking volunteers to provide input to government, that it's an appropriate expenditure and would choose to do so. Again, I'm not going to try to speak to what their decision to spend money might be in the 03-05 biennium, but that could be a policy decision on the part of the governor's office. That second language, or excuse me, that language also, when compared with Section 6, Subsection 3, that occurs on page 3, lines 9 through 11, current language says that in addition to other funds appropriated to the governor for the commission, that implies that there could be future appropriation. Such appropriation might be from either this legislative assembly or that it could be, it could leave open the opportunity for the governor to come to the emergency board and seek an appropriation from the emergency fund. Again, we simply want to bring that budgetary sequence to your attention. The language also points out that the commission may accept gifts and grants from public and private sources to be used to carry out the purposes for which the commission was established. And I'd like to also loop that back, if I might, to Section 1, where it establishes the commission in the office of the governor. That then becomes a governor's office function. And there's a bit of a discrepancy then between that and indicating that the commission may be able to accept gifts and grants. And budgetarily, it would make more sense to have the governor's office receiving the money to be expended for the purposes of the commission. So the governor would receive it on behalf of the commission and expend it on behalf of the commission, but the commission is not a budgeted functioning entity within government, especially since it's principally not legislative and it's also temporary.
Mr. Chair, can I just address their concerns? Thank you so much. And I just wanted to say we spoke to the governor's office this morning, and that's consistent with what the governor is very interested in this commission. They said they would like to have language that says the governor may accept gifts and grants for purposes of supporting the commission, and that one of the things they suggested is adding that the governor need not expend money until sufficient money has been received for this purpose. So, in other words, we don't want to requiring that the governor expend money from his budget for this unless there's private money coming in to compensate. That's the whole purpose. The governor's interested. This is consistent with their hunger relief activities, and we also don't want to put an undue burden on the governor's budget, and so that's one of the reasons that we're working out language with the governor's office, and unfortunately we couldn't have a representative here. But we're working with them on that.
Here's what I'm going to suggest, because we need to get moving here. And members, I have already alerted the chief clerk's office and the speaker's office that we are going to probably miss most of the floor session, but we will be there in time for the 11 o'clock joint session.
Mr. Chair, we're not voting on anything today.
No.
That's correct?
That's correct.
Just want to make sure.
Oh, well, that's rather interesting, because I was going to see if you wanted to do something with this bill, but that's fine. I'll close the work session. We can just move on.
No, I'm talking about the floor session.
In floor.
Yeah.
No,
Okay.
Otherwise, yeah, we can go ahead and go there.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not even sure that I answered your question, which would be perhaps true to form for Adrian, but insofar as the request to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, what I would suggest that if the suggested amendments in terms of the governor not needing to expend additional funds until such sufficient funds had been received for purposes of the commission, is that our office's view would be likely that while I would issue an impact statement indicating the mechanism for this to occur, we would assume, I believe, that the governor, if the office required additional expenditure limitation of other funds such at such time as the funds were received and needed to be expended could come to the emergency board to seek another funds expenditure limitation increase for that purpose. And therefore, it need not go through Ways and Means at this point.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
You're ready for some motions on there.
I would be ready for a motion on this bill.
Move that we adopt the dash two amendments into House Bill 3573.
Representative Przanski moves the adoption of, the dash two amendments into House Bill 3573. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Przanski.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 3573 as a amended to the floor with a D-pass recommendation and to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 3573 to the floor as amended to the floor with a D-pass recommendation and that we rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Representative Kitts.
Representative Kribble, I was originally a yes on this bill. After hearing some of the testimony today, I have some concerns. First of all, my concern is that we're raising money to look at the problem of hunger and look at the problem of poverty as opposed to addressing it. I don't know how many more commissions, and I don't think that it's been proven that there is no fiscal. It's an assumptive position that we're taking. In light of the fact that I said I would vote yes, I will vote yes in committee, and I'm going to have to look further on this on the floor. And I say that as a courtesy to the sponsor of the bill that we should probably talk further, but I will vote yes in committee.
Mr. Chair, if I could just one clarification.
Representative Przanski.
My understanding of how the dash twos are, your statement, I assume meaning the state was going to be raising money, where in fact it's going to be nonprofits will be generating the income for the commission and, if necessary, funding the governor's budget or, let's say, discretionary funds to pay for travel expenses and stuff like that. So it's not actually the state actually raising money.
And again, I understand if I may respond to that. I don't feel like that's been proven at this point. I think it's assumptive that the funds will be raised. So I would prefer that they raise the money and then come back to the state and say, we have the money. Now let's start the commission. So that's my concern.
Okay. Appreciate that. Representative Nelson?
Thank you. I'd like to make a direct comment in that.
This is the time.
Thank you. Well, for the past 4 years, I have contacted every individual that I can find, from the former governor's office to the current, to the chair of the Oregon Food Bank, YCAP, and ask, what does it take to end hunger in this state? Because that's been my, most aggressive concern. And cannot get a number. I think in line with this bill, we should end the Hunger Task Force, which has yet to come back with a number, or put together a network for all of our agricultural programs and foods that are available. And I hope this does not end this bill, end like the PUC, 501(c) public service corporation or public service entity that was formed with our money and then ends up paying a director $120,000 to run it. I find that's offensive. So I just want to say that. I hope that this is going to be an action group and make it happen, and I'm all for it, and let's go. But let's be somebody this time that makes it happen. The task force have not ended hunger, nor the governor.
Other comments? Okay. Gina, call the roll, please. Excused.
Aye.
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 No.
No. House Bill 3573, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed, and it's on to the floor. Representative Dingfelder, we will have her carry the bill. And so with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3573. I'm going to, let's see here. We need to, let me go back to, I wonder if we can clean, 3380 is going to be pretty fast, isn't it? Let's open a work session on House Bill 3380. I don't have any members in the room. God, I hope not. Come on up, Fred.
If I may,
tell us real quickly what this thing does and what you want.
Joined by representatives of the semi-independent agencies. The staff needs to bring you copies of the amendments because the measure has been, we will work off of the amendments to, for it to make sense. You need the -5 and the -2 amendments to House Bill 3380.
Okay, we have the -2s.
Fives are coming. As you can.
Fives are on their way.
It commences with a letter from Representative Butler, who says he's been a long advocate of changing our professional boards to semi-independent status. And for those of, I don't know if you've dealt with any semi-independent status boards before, but in the mid-90s, we started a process of taking boards that were interested in becoming semi-independent and, in effect, moving them out of state government partially. Principally, the thing that doesn't happen is their budgets go through Ways and Means. If you've got the -5 amendments in front of you, I will discuss them.
We do?
The -5 amendments are a rewrite of the bill. These amendments allow semi-independent boards to borrow money to purchase real property, such as an office building. The original authorizing statutes provided boards could own real property, but the authority to borrow money to buy such property was unclear in the statute. Sub 2 and sub 3 on page 1 of the -5 amendments and sub 4 on page 2 of the -5 amendments make it very clear that they can borrow money to buy the buildings. The original law said they could own real property, but they didn't. The original law did not make it clear that they could borrow money to buy the real property. And the -5 amendments clarify their authority to borrow money to buy real property. Now, the legislative council took some took the opportunity to make some other minor changes, but the essence of the -5 amendments is to make it clear that the semi-independent boards can borrow money to buy real property.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
Fred, could you, I understand what the concept is, but basically who's going to be on the hook for that debt if they go out to borrow it? If they're a quasi-state agency, is the state somehow also going to be obligated if there's a default?
It is my understanding that the language is very clear that the state is not on the hook. And we have been working with the Department of Treasury on these amendments as well. And the language essentially was drafted by the Attorney General's office. And it is very clear that the people that support the semi-independent boards are the ones that, and in fact, there's language in here that says statute laws of this state repayable solely from fees. I'm looking on line 11 on page 1 of the -5. Solely from fees or other revenues generated by the board's leases, including lease with option to purchase. So they are, the language is designed to make it very clear that if you loan one of these agencies money, you're going to look to the agency for the collection.
It doesn't have one.
It does not have one. Move on to the -2 amendments. The dash two amendments relate solely to the appraiser certification and licensure board, which went out in last session. It makes two changes.
But I have no quorum.
You can keep a quorum. You can keep four, then I need two. You got somebody gone?
Yeah, I got somebody gone.
I'll back in. Okay, then I need two. Let him go.
Do I have two volunteers to go up to the floor?
For Ramona, I will.
Gets me.
Yeah, you'll do things for Ramona you'd never think of doing for me.
So selfless. Thank you.
All right, do I have another volunteer?
Sure.
Did you say Representative Brzezinski, you would go?
John.
All right, go.
Thank you.
The dash two amendments affect only the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board. They make two changes. The first one would allow the board to carry out a statutory charge to make nationwide criminal record checks. The law specifically must mention fingerprinting to allow a nationwide criminal record check, and when the statute that they used didn't mention fingerprinting, so they can't go to the FBI to get nationwide checks. And this adds the word fingerprinting, which allows them to do that. The second provision of the dash two amendments correct an oversight, and that is that the civil penalty money was not earmarked for the operation of the board. These amendments correct that oversight and say civil penalty money, which the board levies, can be used by the board, in effect. These are simple, clean, technical changes that we need to make that process work, and I urge your affirmative action on it.
Okay. You have questions, Representative Brzezinski?
I guess one clarification. This apparently is for all semi-governmental agencies. Is it my understanding none of their budgets have any oversight by the legislature through the process of budgeting? I just want to...
That is correct. Their budget, they do not bring a budget to the legislative process. We have an expert here that can brief us on that process if you'd like to hear it. There are 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 boards that are presently in the semi-independent status. Physical therapy, massage, geology, optometry, architects, engineers, landscape contractors, landscape architects, and appraisers.
And their fee generated as to how they're...
All self-supporting, 100% self-supporting.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you for being here.
We would encourage you to adopt the Dash 5 and the Dash 2 amendments and send the bill to
court. Well, I'd just like to ask my question first.
Representative Nelson, ask your question.
Okay. It says, expands the description of powers, am I on the right bill, 3380?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Of semi-independent state agency. Now, if we're talking agencies, or are we talking OHSU and SAIF and one more that's being proposed by the governor this year? You're talking semi-independent, and those... Two happen to be two, I think, are semi-independent.
They are, but they're governed by different statutes than the licensing boards that we're talking about here. The boards that we're talking about here, and I understand the legislative council use of the word agencies, but the ORS references are to the professional licensing boards.
So,
the OHSU and the State Accident Insurance Fund have their own sections of the statutes and their own authorities, and they already can own property and do indebtedness and do all these things. These, we're talking about the licensing board, professional licensing boards here.
Okay, and follow up, Mr. Chair. My issue with this is... why these boards need to purchase real property.
Because they can say they can save their, it is less expensive for them to operate that way, and they can save the professionals who are licensed with them money.
In that last follow-up is that the reason I'm bringing this up is because we just seem to have had a similar situation with the commodity commissions, basically, who are marketing on behalf of certain members. Now, it's my understanding that these boards function for their membership.
That is correct, and their members essentially operate the board.
Have the voice to vote yay or nay on this, on these acquisitions.
The board membership would have the.
The board membership would make the decisions.
And do they under the law?
Not the licensee necessarily.
Okay, then I have one more follow-up, Ms. Chair, because I think what we're going to find in this same situation is what just happened in the commodity commissions, which came down for a ruling from the Supreme Court, is if you're spending the money of your membership without their having the right to exercise their First Amendment, which is their advice on what is being done, then you're in violation of that First Amendment and subject to much legal action.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could I just get an answer to that?
Well, the commodity commissions are funded by a percentage on sales, and anybody who sells pays. But if you are a licensing, if it's a licensing board, for example, to appraise property in the in Oregon, you have to go and buy and get a license from the licensing board, and you pay a fee for that license, and that's how the board is funded. And if the board and the board uses that money to rent real property for the staff, and maybe they buy real property instead of renting it. And the original statutes that set up the semi-independent agency made it very clear they could own real property. They just didn't allow you to borrow money to pay for it. But the funding for a semi-independent professional board is completely different than the funding for a commodity commission.
Did that answer your question?
No, sir, but I wish we had counsel.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, it's saying semi-independent, and since the state has no discretion over these boards and commissions' budgets because they are fee-based and not general fund, aren't these boards and commissions, however, benefiting in some way because they are affiliated with the state in being able to borrow the money for the property?
I'm not. Could you repeat? Sorry, I missed the point of the question.
So, being semi-independent means that they are affiliated with the state. Now, how does the state affiliation by these boards and these commissions benefit them in borrowing money for this property?
I don't know that being affiliated with the state will benefit them in borrowing money or not. That would be a free market. They would go to their bank and say, or go to a bank or mortgage broker or something and say, we want to borrow money to buy this building, and they would figure out an interest rate, and they are required to use the Attorney General's office. So the Attorney General's office would review the transaction, and if it fit and the parties agreed, they could borrow the money.
And the lender,
of course, would take a look at the cash flow to make sure that they were going to get paid back. It's not the people that have money to loan are very careful about those provisions.
What would happen if one of these landscape, contractor board was suddenly abolished and they had a loan out for purchasing and developing property, and were not, they weren't able to pay it back, and the state abolished that board.
My guess is the lender would foreclose on the real property.
And who would be liable for this thing?
Well, the lender would foreclose on the property, is my guess is what would happen.
And there would be no liability at all by the state?
That is correct.
Okay.
Okay, so I think that he may have been just clarifying, but would you go ahead and just one more time?
Fred, I guess I just want to make sure. I think we've got enough on the record here, but looking at the dash fives and looking at lines 15 through 19, where it talks about the right to receive payment from a board under an agreement entered into under the subsection, so basically talking about the payment for a building in this case, it also states that the... there can't be a transfer or an assignment in whole or in part without the written consent of DAS. My concern is if DAS has that type of control over these assignments or transfers, doesn't that somehow put us in a position that we, meaning the state, could in fact be sued? And because we do have some control over and we're some type of a beneficiary,
well,
to the contracts?
That language has is there at the request of the Treasury Department.
Okay.
And one of the changes that we're going to be making in the Senate is to delete the subsection in line 17. They just came in the middle of the hearing and said they were concerned about that, and I didn't want to try to run an we're getting late in the day and we need to move the bill, and I agreed to take that out in the Senate. But the reason for this language is a bad experience that Treasury had several years ago where the higher education owed somebody a stream of income, and they monetized it and issued certificates of participation on the stream of income. And Treasury doesn't want, puts in all their state contracts now that you can't assign the contract without approval. And the idea is to keep that stream of money coming from either the state or, in this case, a semi-independent agency that looks like the state, from being available to be converted into a market security and sold on the market that might affect our credit rating in New York.
Right.
And that is the purpose of that. Whether a lawyer could look at that and say, well, I can sue state government for this for some reason is not a question I'm competent to answer.
Okay. The part that you're saying the Treasury now wants to take out is in the dash fives?
Well, they what they want to do is make sure that this right to review covers the entire section and not just the subsection.
Gotcha.
So the language... on sub 4, borrowing money for the needs of the board, is also covered by the right of assignment of the income, and that means the lender can't sell the loan to somebody else without approval of DAS. But I don't think it makes the state. I don't believe it makes the state liable for the debt.
Okay. Did you have a follow-up?
I don't have a follow-up. I've got a suggestion. To me, there's some clarification. I'm supportive of the bill, but I want to make certain that we know before we go forward where we're going, and either legal counsel or someone from the Treasury or something, because I know we're going to recess and continue this afternoon. Maybe we can have someone come in just to clarify so we got the record straight and we know what the obligation of the state is or isn't.
Okay. Could we ask legislative counsel then to come in and for this afternoon and give us a clarification on the issues that Representative Przanski and Representative Nelson have raised also? Representative Nelson?
But I did just want to point out, Mr. Chair, that I think this is very important because, for example, the Board of Trustees of the Children's Trust Fund is a semi-independent entity. And I think we're going to find ourselves a little bit challenged here. If you go into look at 462 and anyway, I think we...
Well, let's let... I understand the issues that you're raising, Representative. So what I'd like to do, because we need to get up to the floor. What I would like to do is I'll recess this work session, and then what we can do is this will be another one that we'll come back to this afternoon. I've asked Patrick to ask Legislative Council if they would come in and just clarify a couple of things that Representative Nelson, you, and Representative Worth, and Representative Krasanski have raised with regards to this bill that Mr. Vanetta has claimed to be incompetent to answer. So,
thank you.
Not a jab, Fred. Not a jab.
I don't give the legislature legal advice.
You know, probably a good idea. I tried it once, but it didn't seem to. They didn't follow it. So, anyway, that was before I was a member, though. You know. So anyway, so with that, then I'm going to recess the work session on 3380. I'm going to recess, members. I would like us to come back at 4 o'clock. And if for some reason we can't come back here, then we will find a room. But we've got some things that we need to try to wrap up this afternoon. And I will tell you that I do not intend to go beyond about 5 o'clock, which means that anybody that comes up here to speak this afternoon, you are on notice. You better talk fast and short. Because I'm not going to. Yes, Representative Nelson.
May I just ask if y'all voted on 2410 and 3219 while I was gone?
We did vote on 2410. And if you would wait until, if you and Representative Worth would wait until this afternoon,
but
when we have, we voted on 2410 and we voted on.
So if you gavel, we're still inclusive.
Yes.
We'll work later.
Yeah, we can't. We're going to recess.
Okay.
We
can't
record their votes now anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have to have 5 members here to suspend rules. That's the problem. So, which is what I'm going to require. So I'm going to recess until 4 p.m.
Whatever.